You're listening to the Ayn Rand Institute Live podcast series. Making Sense of the Israeli-Palestinian Conflict by Ilan Jordan.
So I want to take you back a couple of years to when we had a different administration in the White House. Do you guys remember John Kerry? Yeah. Now, he was our Secretary of State for a while. He was given the assignment to go around the Middle East and drum up a coalition against the Islamic State. This happened in 2014. If you remember, in 2014, this group of people calling themselves the Islamic State took over parts of Iraq and Syria, and it caught a lot of people by surprise. And there was a lot of panic. So what do we do about it? So John Kerry went around the Middle East. That's his job. And when he came back, he had a really important discovery. So one of the press conferences he gave at that time, he conveyed this finding. So he told a bunch of reporters, look, I sat down with all kinds of leaders in that part of the world, diplomats, all sorts of people in the know, and they all told me, I didn't prompt them, they told me spontaneously, that here's something we need to be aware of. The fact that the Israeli-Palestinian conflict is unresolved, which is true, it's not resolved, far from it, that fact is hugely significant. Because, and here's what Kerry found, according to all the people he spoke to, the fact that there's no resolution is a driver, a huge driver of recruitment and street anger. Now, when he says recruitment, he means for the jihadists in general, but specifically for Islamic State. And when he says street anger, he means particularly anti-American sentiment. Now, you might ask, which I think is a natural question, why anger against America? What have we done? I mean, we're not part of this conflict. Well, yes and no. We're very distant from it geographically, but you might not know this, but for the last 25 years, America has been hugely involved in this conflict. It has had two major roles in it. One is it has promised to be a broker for negotiating a peace settlement. This was kicked off in 1993 under the Clinton administration. So there's a huge diplomatic investment. We spend a lot of time trying to unravel this. And the second one is financial, which is nothing to scoff at. And the United States has invested in both sides. It's given aid to Israel and a lot of aid to the Palestinian side to the tune of hundreds of millions of dollars. So whether you like it or not, whether this is wise or unwise, and that's something we should explore, America has been deeply involved in it. So you can understand the view, whether you agree with it or not, that people see America as hugely looming over this conflict. Now, I don't agree with John Kerry's assessment that this fact and the implication in his view is our failure to bring about a resolution, the American failure here, is a huge moral stain. I don't think that's quite right. I do think there's something to the link between this conflict and the Islamist movement, and I'll say more about that in today's talk. But I think whatever your view of Kerry's claim is, there's clearly a question here. What is America's role here? What has it been? What should it be? And I think it's an important question to unravel, mainly because we have been so involved, and there's a question, should we continue in that path? And I don't think we should. What should it look like? What is the path here? What is the path to a happy ending, as someone asked me at the beginning? And I think there are paths to a happy ending. They're hard. So the question I want to explore today is, what exactly has our role been? And to get that, to get some clarity on what that is and what it should be, I think we have to start with, well, what's going on in this conflict? Because these are two very closely related things. You have to have a view of what this conflict is about, and then once you have that, then you can evaluate what we've done and what we should be doing. So those are the two points I want to explore today and help you get some purchase, some grip, some clarity on what's going on. And I've called this making sense of the conflict because I'm not promising you full, deep understanding. That takes a long time. I'm still working on that. I think I've got it. But I'm going to give you the ability to kind of have a framework for seeing what actually happened in a way that I think is manageable. It's sort of a, reducing a lot of the concretes and the units so that you have something that you can hold on to. And then with that, I think you'll come away better equipped to evaluate the different accounts that people offer about what we should be doing and what the consequences have been. So that's my goal today, is to help you begin to make sense of this conflict and come to a view of what we should be doing here. Because I think there is a huge stake for us in it. So that's the plan. We're going to talk about the conflict. I'm going to give you sort of the landscape of the debate about it. And then we're going to have a Q&A with Yaron Brook. And I'm going to say this a few times, but ask me questions at the end about anything that I haven't covered or I have covered but it isn't clear. The talk is going to cover just some aspects of a very big topic. And you should have questions. And I really want to get your questions and address them. So the payoff for you, what I want you to come away with at the end of this presentation, is that you'll have an orientation to what is the basic issue here at the conflict, how is it unraveled, how is it developed, in a way that's manageable and retainable. That's part of the challenge here. And then I think I want you to come away better equipped to evaluate what we've been doing and what we should be doing, so you can have a view of that. Now, I want to signal to you some of my conclusions. So I have very definite views about what we should be doing. I think there's a big American stake here, and I'll elaborate on that. But part of what I want you to get in looking at this debate is I want to give you a sense of where my views are situated in this debate, because I think they really stand out. And I think I'm right, and I think one of the things that's helped me get clarity on this is that I've approached it from a perspective that's distinctive. And I think it's the fact that I'm approaching it from a philosophic perspective, and specifically from an objectivist perspective. So one of the points I want to convey to you, and it was going to be a subtext to the talk, and then I thought, that's not a good idea. I just tell them what I'm going to do. And the point is, I think it's a way to see how objectivism is hugely, hugely valuable as a means of understanding the world and solving problems. Now, a lot of us in this room are here because we've learned about Ayn Rand's philosophy, and in our own lives, we see its huge value. And I can speak for myself. It's enabled me to achieve my happiness, clarity of knowledge, clarity of goals. And I think a lot of you have that experience. That's true on a massive scale when you're trying to understand cultural, political issues. I think that's part of the value of this philosophy. It is really a philosophy for living on Earth. That's part of the background here. All right, so let's get to the intimidating stuff, okay? The conflict. And I say that speaking autobiographically. So when I started researching this, I thought I knew what I was doing, and quickly you realize how little you know. I started making all sorts of diagrams and flow charts, and I'm not going to put those up on the wall today. There are no flow charts, no diagrams. I would love to do that. What I'm going to do is simplify it for you. And the way to do that, I think, is to start with these basic questions. Who's involved? What are they about? What are they trying to do? And sort of when along a timeline has this happened? And I'm going to package this for you in terms of three basic stages. And you'll see how they interconnect. And I think at the end of it, when you see the three stages, it'll give you kind of a holistic picture of what's happened. So let's run through this. Now, there are a lot of who's, a lot of people involved here, and a lot of timeline. But so I'm just going to condense it to a more succinct period. So the dotted line means it goes back in time. And all the dates I've listed here are significant conflict, whether war or uprisings or just violent clashes. You don't have to remember these dates. Some of you will recognize what the dates are. They're significant milestones along the development of this conflict. What I want to do is break this down for you. So definitely ask me about the period before 1947. So let's work through this. So the first big part of this, the first big chunk, is called the Arab-Israeli conflict. Why is it called that? The name of this conflict has changed over time, and you'll see why. Why is it called that? Well, the adversaries were, on the one hand, is easy. It's Israel, right? It's 1947-48. That's when there's a partition plan that the United Nations decides, okay, there's a lot of conflict in this area. We're going to divide this land between an Arab state and a Jewish state, and so that's the founding of Israel. That doesn't go the way anyone plans it to. The Arab side says, we don't want this, and so there's no Arab state. But Israel does come about. There's a massive war in 1947-48. Who's on the other side of the war? Now, it's called the Arab-Israeli conflict because it's mostly Arab nations around Israel. So, chiefly Egypt, Lebanon, I think, was involved at some point. That comes later. So, it's Egypt, Syria, and Jordan as sort of the big players here. And then even Iraq, which is pretty far away, and Saudi Arabia comes along. Now, what are they after? What are they coming for? What's their purpose in invading this time? Now, they don't want the partition plan. They don't want there to be an Israel. But what are they really after? What are they trying to get out of this? I think if you look at what they said and what they did, it was basically territory and loot. I mean, these are authoritarian regimes. And what they wanted to do is grab a whole bunch of land. There's access to the Mediterranean. There's other resources. And basically aggrandize, get more territory for themselves. They were not particularly concerned with the Arab population within Israel. They didn't really care about them. Okay, so that's the big phase. And there's a number of clashes. So 47, 48, there's the Suez Crisis you might have heard about in 56. A big turning point 50 years ago, 1967. So that's sort of the big chunk of this. So this is where it's Arab countries versus Israel trying to conquer that territory. Okay, so those are the basic characters involved here. Good. Okay, and then we get to the next stage. So now there's an interesting development in the conflict because the Arab states realize, you know what, it doesn't really work. We haven't been able, three or four times they basically tried to, in their words, liquidate Israel. So they haven't succeeded in that goal. And they figure, you know what, let's try this other tactic. Let's empower these groups of Palestinian fighters who are sort of in the model of guerrilla warriors, and let's have them be our agents. And in fact, this is when you get the Palestinian movement really being born. And it's born as an instrument of these countries, these authoritarian dictatorships. The Palestinian Liberation Organization, I think by a show of hands, how many people have heard of that? Okay, most of you, good. Now, that is it's a big umbrella group with lots of factions, a lot of chaos inside of it. But it was sort of instigated by Egypt and funded by Egypt, Syria, and Iraq predominantly. And they each had their own factions that they were supporting. The Palestinians in this organization, the warriors as they saw themselves, were essentially mercenaries for the state sponsors. So for example, they would try to overthrow, so Egypt tried to overthrow Jordan using some of these fighters. And they tried to unseat Syria. And there's all kinds of clashes that have very little to do with the Palestinian cause as you know it today. This was again an attempt by dictatorial regimes to gain more power, to overthrow each other and gain territory and loot. Now, what's significant about this period is the Palestinian Liberation Organization, or the PLO, is now center stage, and the Arab states have stepped back. They're in the shadows more than they were in the beginning. And the Palestinian organization puts itself forward as the liberator, or the savior, the righter of wrongs for a group who are seen as the little guy, the Palestinians. They're the victims, right? And so that gives the movement a kind of moral standing that the Arab states, who are so obviously intent on conquest, didn't have. They couldn't get that kind of credibility. Whereas the PLO, well, we're liberation movement, right? And there's a real kind of mystique to that back in the mid-70s and late 60s. Okay, so the PLO, if you look at their founding documents, look at their statements, what are they about? Well, I think the easiest way to capture it is this. It's a group of would-be dictators seeking territory. And this is based on my assessment of their history. So if you look at what they did and what they've said they want to do, everywhere they've gained any kind of political power, they've created mini dictatorships. This happened numerous times over the years. And if you're curious, ask me about that. And in fact, they are sort of, they want to be those Arab states you saw at the beginning in the earlier phase. And the way that they think that you have to do that is to collapse Israel. You have to attack it, and in their words, again, liquidate it. And all of this is put in terms that are couched and intended to win over people. So this is liberation. So liberation by means of destroying what is, at the time, the only free country in that part of the world, and we'll say more about that. Okay, so you see these are overlapping, and there's a lot of overlap, because the people involved in the conflict don't go away, they just sort of step back from the frontier. Let's get to the last, so PLO factions. Don't worry about the alphabet soup. I put it here because I want to indicate to you that there were a lot of different groups, and it's interesting who they were and what they're about, and you can ask me about that. This is a partial list. What they have in common is that they're sort of leftist, nationalist, and some of them are more religious than others, but it's all bad. I mean, their heroes are Mao Zedong and Che Guevara and Fidel Castro, and they openly seek to ally themselves with those kinds of dictatorial regimes. Okay, so now we get to the third and final phase, which I think the one you've probably heard about if you follow the news. Now on the other side of this equation is the jihadist movement. And it really takes off in the late 80s, and it sort of the big milestone is 2006, when Hamas wins an election in the Palestinian territories, an election which, by the way, the United States fought for and endorsed and wanted to see happen. So that's the phase we're in. Now, what are the jihadists about? Now, this is probably more familiar to you. They are about a free society of individual rights. No, obviously not, right? Obviously not. I mean, now that's so. What I think is interesting is that the progression here is it's gone from bad to worse to even worse, because these guys, the jihadists, are so openly against freedom. There isn't even a pretense of liberation anymore. This is what we're here to do is to get rid of this other country, these heretic, you know, infidel Jews, and Jews are a particularly bad kind of infidel, by the way. We're going to get rid of them, and in place we're going to create a society subservient to Islamic rule as a totalitarian system. And so this is sort of these are the blood brothers of the Taliban, the Islamic State, Iran, Saudi Arabia, the Muslim Brotherhood. That's the axis that we're looking at here. And the groups involved are, I mean, Iran is the chief funder and inspiration here. It helps to found these other groups of Palestinian Islamic Jihad. Hamas, that's an acronym for the Islamic Resistance Movement. They're pretty open about that. How many people have heard of Hezbollah, the Lebanese? Yeah, Hezbollah means army of God. No pretense about what they're really about. And again, their goal is to, we want to, quote, liquidate this country in the name of creating a religious kind of authoritarianism. So that gives you kind of an overview, and again, these overlap, because what I'm trying to illustrate here is who's at the forefront, who's the vanguard of this cause. What they have in common is they're all against this one country, and what they want to accomplish is something that is a net, is disastrous, right? They want something that is against freedom in a meaning, in a really deep way. So these three phases, I think, are a way to kind of package a very complex history and development. What I want to do is kind of give you this picture of, these are all the characters, right? So it's helpful to think of them as three kind of developmental phases. I want to say a word about the other side of this conflict, right? So there's obviously two sides. A word or two about Israel. So I've already hinted my view of it. I said that it's the only free country in that part of the world. I think it's worth saying a bit more. It is in a region that is essentially ravaged by anarchy and various forms of tyranny right now. If you go there right now, that's what you'll find. And it's been like that for hundreds of years. it's a country where there really is some meaningful degree of freedom. There is freedom of speech, freedom of religion, economic freedom. Now, would talk to some of the Israelis here. Should there be more economic freedom? Yes, there should be some more here. But fundamentally, is there freedom? Yes. If you go across the border to Jordan or any of these other countries nearby, in Egypt and Saudi Arabia and so forth, is there freedom there? No, there isn't. And that is a fundamental difference. I think it speaks to the character of that country. Israel is a mixed economy in the terms that Ayn Rand coined, which means there are elements of control and elements of freedom, but fundamentally it is a free country. It's serious conflicts over the role of religion in society, but fundamentally they're still not dominant, and it's a fundamentally secular society. So even with the conflicts they have over the role of religion in the state. And finally, I think it's significant that if you've read Ayn Rand's works and you understand some of the history of capitalism, you know that freedom enables progress and flourishing. Freedom is what humans need in order to succeed and thrive. And you see that. You see that freedom enables flourishing in Israel because it's not only free economically, you can see the fruits of that. In classic measures of human progress, like infant mortality and life expectancy, it easily outclasses all of its neighbors by wide margins. And you might have heard of Israel's nickname in the last 10, 15 years. It's called the Startup Nation. And that's because it has a massive concentration of high-tech and life sciences startups. A lot of the apps on our phones are developed there. A lot of the back-end technology of the internet arises there. It's just teeming with high-tech development and amazing innovation. So those are the two sides. And my summary of where we are in this conflict is that on the one hand, you have what is basically a free society facing what is a movement now in the jihadist form that is an enemy of freedom in every possible way. That's where what we're looking at. All right, so what I've tried to give you is a picture of the conflict, a division of it into three basic phases that I see this progression where it's unfolded, and how we got to where we are today with the adversaries and who they are and what they're trying to accomplish. So what I want to do now is turn to give you a picture of what is the landscape of the debate, right? So using that outline of what the conflict is about, we can now evaluate or look at the views that people have about what America's role has been and what it should be. And I want to look at it, I want to use that question, what should it be? Because that brings out a really important part of this debate. And it's this issue. The debate is missing something. And the way to see that is to see the moral dimension of the views out there. And what's missing is a real serious concern for moral judgment. And I think what I try to bring to this, what I set out to do, is to bring that in, and I think that's how to get clarity and how to get to solutions. So it might surprise you to hear that the debate is missing a concern for morality, because some of the views that you'll hear about or that you've already heard about are all about justice, right? Justice for Palestine, and there's justice for the Jews and so forth. But I think fundamentally the views that we're going to look at negate real moral thinking. And in my view, you can't understand these issues without serious moral thinking. And I think that's the lesson you get taking an objectivist perspective on this. So here's the first view. The first view is, and I tried to condense it to tweet length, though I don't recommend tweeting it because you need a whole context, and that's the point of today's talk. But the first view you'll hear about, and there's a lot of people who hold this, it's stop the unconditional bias toward Israel and do right by the Palestinians. So let's unpack that, and I'll tell you some of the people who hold this kind of view. So there's a professor at Columbia called Rashid Khalidi. He's a really eminent thinker. He is a named chair. He's an editor of a journal that's really significant in the field. And he's one of the people who have this view. There's two professors who wrote a book. Their names are John Mearsheimer and Steve Walt. One's at Harvard, one's at Chicago. And if you study international relations and you haven't read their stuff, you're doing it wrong, because they're really significant thinkers. So those are some of the people who hold this view. Now, what does it really mean? So they have an account of America's involvement here, and they will show you evidence that, look, in all these negotiations over the last 20 plus years, America has put its thumb on the scale on the side of Israel. Really kind of fraudulently pretended to be impartial, and in fact it was biased toward Israel. That's the Khalidi version of this view. And he thinks this has been a huge fraud, like really cheated the Palestinians out of their due. And if you hope to get anything like a resolution, you need to do right by them. The Walt and Mearsheimer view is slightly different. They also think America has been irrationally biased towards Israel. And for them, this is more of the John Kerry view that I started with. You'll hear the echo of it. It's, we've been so favorable to Israel that it's kind of blowing back at us, right? It creates antagonism and hostility, so obviously we need to remedy that, right? Now, listening to that, that's sort of a very brief summary of their view, but just listening to that, something should bother you about it, at least one thing. Just having heard what I presented about the sort of the contours of this conflict, who the characters are. Now, you might, let me put aside the claims about bias. So, I don't think the factual claims are well-grounded. I think you can debate some of the details of who said what in what negotiation. It's a very legalistic kind of place. But even if you concede that that stuff is true, there's still a problem here. Khalidi and his colleagues on this view, they have a sort of a blind spot to what is the Palestinian cause about? What is it? Now, they have, if you ask me, it's a deluded view or rose-colored view. They don't take seriously the fact that this cause arose as a development of dictatorships trying to conquer territory, a movement that it used terrorism as a means deliberately because it's trying to implode a country. That part of it just isn't real to them. They don't take it seriously. But even more significant, now, so they've written their books in the last 5 to 10 years, so they have reason to be aware of this fact. They're not that concerned with the fact that the Palestinian cause has essentially become an Islamist movement, like it's hugely involved in that. That's not a big deal to them. Yeah, there's some wackos, they'll tell you, but basically the Palestinian cause is good, and it deserves to be dealt with differently. Now, I don't think you can get to that view. I don't think that's warranted. You can't separate out what this movement really is about from what it claims to do. So part of what they do, and this is an important point and we'll come back to it, I just want to present it sort of in outline here. What they do is they take the Palestinian cause at face value. The Palestinians say they want peace in a state for themselves. That must be what they want. How could it be anything else? Right? Now, you might say that's naive, given any kind of acquaintance with the history of what's happened. But I don't think it is naive. I think there's an element of a refusal to really think critically about the Palestinian side of this. So if the claim is do right by the Palestinians, you have to have an account of what the Palestinians are about. So to do right by them, does that mean to satisfy their desire for a new tyranny? A new totalitarian state? Is that really going to do anyone any good? That doesn't add up. So there's a way in which this whole view, though it's claiming to stand for rectifying a wrong here, it's really making a mockery of what it looks like to judge both sides. They have very harsh things to say about Israel, and that's, you know, you can debate what Israel's role has been, so we don't have to get to that, but you can't then treat the other side as, well, we don't have to ask any questions about them. We know they're good. Well, that doesn't follow. You can't have that view. And the same, similar things are true of the Walt and Mearsheimer perspective. Now, these are probably names you haven't heard of, these academics I mentioned. But the basic view that we've done wrong by the Palestinians, therefore there's a whole bunch of blowback to us, that is, so that's sort of an echo of their perspective, that is very mainstream and common. So who are some of the people who have that view? I think it's significant who they are. I think Jimmy Carter, who won a Nobel Prize for Peace, and was also, I think it was a president. amazing things happen, right? Ban Ki-moon, who was the former head of the UN. There are some military leaders in the United States establishment who have views that are resonant with this. So not exactly the same claims, but basically the theme. So David Petraeus, he was his last job was head of the CIA. And James Mattis, General James Mattis, who's now Secretary of Defense, he's made statements that sort of resonate with this view that our involvement here has been not fair to some party, and that's caused us blowback. But, so there's real influence for this view, but it's really a bad view. It is not at all taking moral judgment seriously. And as a result, you can't really think about the conflict effectively. You're not going to get to valid conclusions. Okay, so that's the view, you know, let's stop being biased toward Israel and let's be good to the Palestinians. I don't think it holds up. Let's turn to the next view, which I think you can summarize like this. How many people have heard of Jerry Falwell, by show of hands? Okay. And Pat Robertson? Okay. Now, how about John Hagee? Have you heard of him? Now, he's less well known, but he's in that triumvirate of evangelical leaders, and I think they share some of his views. Now, John Hagee has made this his issue, and his basic argument is, and I'm being generous by calling it an argument, we have to stand with Israel because the Bible tells us. Okay. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this, but I want to not just, the Bible tells us not just once, not twice, not three times, 22 times. That is real proof, right? Now, it's kind of fun to mock this view because on the face of it, if you aren't already part of his megachurch in San Antonio or elsewhere, why would you find this at all compelling? I don't think there's reason to it. It's a naked appeal to faith. He has other parts of his argument which are interesting because there's an appeal to duty and an appeal to guilt, right? And you can see how it works on people's psychology, which is, you know, the Christian church for hundreds of years has been bad to the Jews. Well, that's true. And we have to make amends for that. And his other view is the Jews have done good by us, right? Look at all the stuff they've done in science. Now, this is a very collectivist perspective, by the way. And why do I put it this way? God blesses those who support Israel. Because he tries to present it as, well, it's obvious we have to stand with them, the Bible tells us, and we have to stand and really fight politically. Now, this is why I decided to include this view. Because the evangelical view that he puts forward, one of the things people like him are good at is vote moving, right? They can deliver votes. And they try to influence policy in a big way. So just to give you a flavor of this, when George Bush was president, some evangelicals went out to his ranch in Crawford, Texas, and picketed outside his house with signs saying, "Stand with Israel." Okay? Then they put up a billboard so that when he's driving back and forth, he couldn't avoid seeing their message. And those are not the only ways they try to influence him, but they really want him to do this. But why? Well, God said so. God's going to pay us back if we do it. And if you don't, God's going to punish you. Okay, it's clearly an appeal to faith. There's no grounds here to take this any more seriously, but it's important because it's influential. There is a version of this. So this is, if you want, this is sort of the caricature of being pro-Israel. Like, this is really unthinking. And the way in which this is a negation of morality, there's many ways of that, but here's a really significant one. So if you were to try to analyze this seriously, you would have to ask John Hagee, okay, you like Israel because God tells you. Okay, well, let's take that for the sake of argument. But there's another side to this conflict, and what do you think about them? What's your view of them, and what should be done about them when they have all kinds of claims and counterclaims? How do you disentangle that and evaluate what to do? So John Hagee says, he has a whole couple of paragraphs in a book saying, well, you know, the Palestinians aren't really a people. They don't have a language. The land was never theirs because God had a blood covenant with the Jews. Okay, blood covenant. But then here's the really interesting part in how this is a completely devoid of, like, this is an assault not just on moral judgment, because he's not interested in evaluating them, or Israel for that matter. It's a real departure from fact. So he has one of the claims the Palestinians make is, in the war of 1947-48, thousands of Palestinians became refugees, right? That's not controversial. The numbers, there's controversy about the numbers, but it's something like between 500,000 and 700,000. Now, there's a real question, what does that mean? Who's responsible? How does that play into today's debate? John Hagee would have you believe a rewritten view of history. He says, there were no real Palestinians at the time, and the ones that came into the country. It's completely the reverse of the facts. So you can't really take this as an argument. And he's not at all concerned with, well, what about their claims? I mean, is there anything to it? Forget about them. We just want to know who God tells us to favor. And again, there are politicians and there are activists who try to push this view. There is a version of this that's secularized, like, that makes it a little, I mean, it's not really fair to call it exactly the same view, but it's a version of this, and it's a kind of, we're pro-Israel because Israel is a democracy, we have shared values, which is often, though not always, often code for religion, and there's military dimensions to it. Now, I think that's a good beginning of a view, because those are important factors about Israel. But again, the same kind of concern arises, which is, that's the beginning of how you might evaluate Israel as one side in this conflict. But what is your view of the other side? And how do you evaluate them? And that's a big hole in the argument. And you can ask me more about that. I think that's the direction you see in the GOP party platform of 2016, for example. Not a complete argument, to put it in short. So I want to go to the third view, which I think is the dominant view. It has been the view American policy has been based on for basically 25 years with variations. So if you look at Bill Clinton, George Bush, or even Barack Obama, and I think it seems to be what Trump is trying to do, though it's still early days, put aside all your moralism stuff and let's just negotiate. Let's come to a deal, and it has to be balanced, because yeah, there's claims on both sides, we know that. And as a result, we can come to a compromise. Now, I mean, this view signals from the beginning that it is unconcerned with morality, right? But it is, in a deep way, negating it, because their view is, if you bring any kind of moral questions into this, you're just going to stop us in our tracks. We're not going to get to any kind of resolution because everyone has a view. We don't want to think about that. We just want to come to a deal. I think you can see the appeal of this to Trump, right? Deals are a big part of who he is. And it's a big appeal to a whole group of people in the diplomatic corps and a lot of politicians. And part of this is there is a pretense at taking each side seriously, though not morally seriously. Can you really find a balance between these two sides? If I told you, and I think this is true, if I made the case that on one side of the stage there is a country that is basically free, trying to create a society where people can live and get on with their lives and build and produce, and on the other side of the stage, over here, there's a movement that has been committed for decades to destroying that society and creating a society hostile to human life and hostile to freedom. If I told you that, and I think that's true, what is the middle ground? Where do you meet? If this guy wants to kill you and this guy wants to live, where do you find that sweet spot? What is that? I'd like to know. Asking for a friend. Because seriously, what do you, now to be serious, there really is no possibility of compromise, right? I mean, this is part of Ayn Rand's analysis. She has a very deep analysis of compromise, and I think it really maps onto this in an insightful way. You can't, and the attempt to do this can only make one side stronger and the other side weaker. And I think that was the consequence of our approach here. And it's critical to see that this approach doesn't get off the ground unless you jettison moral thinking. Because for this to start moving, you have to step away from, they actually want to kill us, we don't want to die. Okay, those are moral considerations. Put those away. Like, you can't get anywhere. And it hasn't worked, right? I mean, to put it mildly, the attempts to bring peace between Israel and the Palestinian leadership in the last 25 years have only made things worse. So in the first 5 years after the signing of these peace accords, or the beginnings of the agreement to have a peace accord, more people died in the conflict than died in the 25 years preceding it. So there's a clear encouragement and empowerment of the side that is hostile to freedom. This is what it looked like. Do you guys remember this? Some of you are probably old enough to remember. This happened in 1993. The guy in the military suit is Yasser Arafat, who is the face of the Palestinian cause for many decades. The guy he's shaking hands with is the Prime Minister of Israel at the time, and the guy in the middle is Bill Clinton. And this took place in the garden of the White House. Grown men wept when they saw this, not because they thought this is a disaster, but because they were so caught up in this idea that you can put morality aside and cut a deal, that they thought history was being made. Bill Clinton said, this is a day that we will remember as the beginning of a new Middle East, the beginning of victory for freedom. When John Kerry was given the assignment under Barack Obama to go back to the Middle East and reboot this, because it failed, right? Go reboot this peace process, as it was called. He told a journalist, the journalist said to him, a lot of people don't think this policy is going to have any chance of succeeding. Look at all the past attempts to reboot it and so on. And John Kerry's answer, I think, really encapsulates sort of the verdict on this, which is, what does this view have to defend itself by? What is its best claim right now? And I think John Kerry captured it, and he said, well, what's the alternative? Like, what are we going to do? And to me, that illustrates the bankruptcy of where you end up when you stop thinking with morality as your framework, a rational perspective on this. You keep going back to this approach, which is sort of, this is the norm. Now, I don't think there are a lot of people who believe today that you can get anywhere by rebooting this, which is part of what the Trump administration is doing. But it's amazingly destructive, and I hope somebody asks me more about that. So I want to summarize these perspectives and then give you a flavor of what mine is and how it stands apart from these. So what we have now is a view where we're not going to look at the Palestinians, we're just going to criticize Israel. So that's the first view. It's essentially a free pass to the Palestinian cause. It's a real rejection of evaluating them. That was the view we started with. John Hagee's evangelical view was, we're not going to judge Israel. We're just going to accept it as that's what God tells us. And who are Palestinians? Are they? Is there even such a thing? I mean, there's such a kind of dropping of the fact. And now we have sort of the middle ground is, let's find a balance between these two sides, regardless of who they are, regardless of what they're actually trying to accomplish. So my suggestion is that what's missing from that, those are the salient views. There are other views, but these, I think, are the really significant ones. What's missing is a real concern for moral judgment. And I want to suggest that that is a key to getting clarity on this conflict and clarity towards what is a path to a solution. And I'm going to just highlight a few elements of that. So I think the way forward requires us to take moral judgment seriously. I want to indicate three elements of this. I think the first two should be fairly clear. If there are two sides to this, you've got to take both and judge them seriously. You can't sort of hand wave towards, well, Israel is a free country, therefore we can't really be critical of it. Or the Palestinians say they want a society, they have claims, well, we're not going to really question that, just take it at face value. That's not serious moral thinking, right? And if you did take moral thinking seriously here, you would come to the view, which I think is right, that there really is no middle ground between a free society and a movement that is now in its Islamist form seeking to obliterate it. The framework that I'm bringing to this, which has been implicit so far, I want to just name it, which is I'm evaluating things. When we talk about looking at this with serious moral judgment, I'm applying what I think is an objective moral standard, which is freedom is a good thing. It's good for people in every time, in every place, everywhere, at all times. It's a universal moral value. And if you take that, that is the benchmark against which to judge both sides. So are the Palestinians for freedom? No, they're against it, the Palestinian cause. And is Israel for it? I think for the most part it is, and that's significant. But that's not the end of the story, because there's still a whole bunch of stuff in the middle about how these two sides have interacted and their claims and counterclaims. And here, this is a point I want to really stress, because I think it's central to getting clarity on what this conflict is about. So you remember when I introduced the view of Khalidi and Mearsheimer and Wald, I said that they're taking the Palestinian cause at face value. And I think a lot of people do. What does that really mean? Well, it's important, and this is what you would have to do to evaluate their claims and counterclaims. So you've probably heard that there's a whole litany of grievances the Palestinians have, right? Some of the more well-known ones, right? There's the refugees, which I mentioned. There's thousands of people, now millions of people, according to them, who were displaced as a result of war. There is, we want a homeland and you've stopped us. And then a third one, which is you probably heard about, is this occupation, right? There's a whole bunch of land, Israel's occupying it, we need to get it back. There are others, but those are significant ones. Now, the idea that these are all equal and equally legitimate grievances, as some people take them, you can't look at it that way. This whole idea of the Palestinian cause is a package deal, to use Ayn Rand's term. What that means is it's putting together things that don't go together. They don't belong, not on the same moral level. They're not equally valid. So let me indicate what that means. Let's take two of these grievances and show you. So what the Palestinian cause has done, it has exploited some illegitimate goals and some legitimate wrongs and put them together and said, look, we're speaking for these victims. And it's a massive con. It's really a fraud. And it's an exploitation of some people who are actual victims. There's no question about that. So let me give you a flavor of this. So if you look at two of these grievances and unpack them, what do you get? Well, let's take the big one. We want a homeland. And then there's another one which you might have heard about, is there's Palestinians whose land is taken over in Israel, expropriated. Okay, so let's take the homeland and that one and put them together. Do they belong together? Can you think about them on the same moral plane? Okay, you want a homeland, a state of your own. What does that really look like? What kind of values is it going to have? What kind of principles are going to guide that state? Is it going to be a free state? The answer to that is no. And the claim that if we only had a homeland, everything would be resolved, you don't solve any problems by creating a new tyranny. You only create new problems. Now, that is an illegitimate grievance. You can't demand to vote yourself into a dictatorship. That's just not a morally legitimate position, in my view. Okay, so that's not a legitimate grievance. You can't complain about that. I don't want to hear that you want slavery. You can't vote yourself into that. Now, let's take another example, which is often put together in the same bucket. Like, here's a bunch of people in Israel who have olive groves, the Palestinians, as they describe themselves, they have olive groves. And next to them, there are some Israelis who are religiously fanatic, who believe that no Arab should have property rights in Israel, right? So what do? They go over and they torch the olive trees, they vandalize property, they intimidate the landowner, and they try to drive him out. Now that is a clear violation of someone's, one individual's right to his property. And I think the Israeli government is responsible for protecting that individual. That is an actual wrong that has to be righted. And you can only right it in a framework, in a society where there is respect for freedom. So if you created a Palestinian state, you would not have solutions for that. You would have that on a massive scale because they actually do expropriate the land of their own people. So I want to give you, that's a quick example of how when you think of these Palestinian grievances that come up, they aren't all in the same category. And you can't think of them that way. And one of the problems that has been in this debate is that people do, and that is incredibly confusing. And it also creates, it kind of gives a free pass to the Palestinian cause, because it makes them appear to be the champions of the little guy, right? And on the moral premises of today's culture, being for the little guy has sort of an instant moral credit to it, right? But that's a fraud in my view. So what I've tried to indicate to you is that in order to really get a handle on this, one has to evaluate the conflict and bring to it a rational moral framework. And without that, all you get are really bad solutions or really bad conceptualizations of the problem that make things worse. So the net result of the attempts to bring peace on the balanced approach, that has made things far, far worse. It has created, in a sense, two Palestinian states that are both hostile, both have committed acts of terror and war against Israel. You can ask me more about that. So it has created new, in effect, terrorist states. So I've wanted to give you a flavor of how I think my view stands out in this debate. So it's a debate where people are running away from real moral thinking. And what we need to do is run toward it. That's what we need. We need a lot more of it. And it needs to be from a rational perspective, that you evaluate people according to objective moral standards. And I think if you do that, then you can find a path out of this. You can get to resolutions. So I want to draw a line here and invite your questions. I think Yaron's going to join me, but the final point I want to just stress for you is this. I hope by now you feel better equipped to evaluate the views out there, that you have a framework for what the conflict has been about, and that you can, I hope now, appreciate some more or more deeply the value of having rational principles. And more broadly, I think in the background is the point that objectivism brings and enables us to really better understand these issues and find real solutions here. So to me, that's part of the value of having a philosophic perspective, and it's what I try to bring in my book. And one of my goals in the talk, and I'm going to be upfront about it, is I want you to be encouraged to read the book when it comes out, and I'll tell you more about that when it does come out. So with that, let me introduce my colleague, Yaron Brook.
Thank you. Just one quick historical question. I understand that Islam treated Judaism as a special case that they are based on, that they should respect, as opposed to Christians who are the enemy. Can you comment on that and how that's evolved? And if it's right?
My understanding is that there's a doctrine that people of the book, so that's their term, meaning Jews and Christians, they get a special leniency, and in certain societies that meant that if they paid a tax, a special tax, they didn't have to convert to Islam. So that was the way of avoiding execution. I don't know that as a rule there's been favorable treatment for the Jews in the history. I mean, you've looked into this too.
Yeah, I don't think there's any reason to assume they've treated Jews better necessarily than Christians. And it depends on the period. Some Muslim regimes were more favorable towards Jews and Christians, and others were less favorable. They were second-class citizens, but they were far superior to pagans and atheists who were just killed. They paid a special tax, and they were. But it really depends on which Muslim era and when you see it. What you didn't see, which I think is interesting, is you didn't see the systemic anti-Semitism that you saw in the Christian world. So if you look at the Christian world in Dark Ages all through today, you saw systemic anti-Semitism. That was not a feature in the Muslim world up until recently. I'd say about 100 years ago, real anti-Semitism appeared in kind of blood, you know, stories about Jews sucking blood and drinking babies' blood and stuff like that, started appearing in the Muslim world about 100 years ago. But they were prevalent in the Christian world, you know, for 2,000 years almost.
I thought this was a fantastic, fascinating, incredible talk. It helped me realize what the real issue is. And from now on, anytime I hear political correctness, I'm going to say moral cowardice. And I think that's exactly what you showed up, that this is an act of moral cowardice on our part. It's a culture of moral cowardice. And I didn't really recognize it as that. And I thank you very much. My question is this: in the New York Times, they constantly come up with this ISIS, otherwise known as ISIL. I think it's like they don't really. Who is this person they're talking or organization? It's like, what is that? What are they really referring to? I think it's like in a way, so you don't really know who the enemy is. They keep saying this. Would you have any comments?
I mean, I think fundamentally, is there evasion of who the Islamist movement is and what they're about? I think there is, and it's massive. And I think you find it across the culture. On the specific question of ISIS and ISIL and the different names for it, I think some of that is they changed their name. And so at the beginning, they were Islamic State of Syria and Iraq, Iraq and Syria, so that's ISIS. And then it's Islamic State in the Levant. Levant is sort of like, it's a vague geographical term for that part of the region. I mean, I think the particular label isn't that important so long as what it points to is clear, and that's where I think there's big failure. They're just real, real evasion on that.
Online argue in favor of Israel, taking Israel's position, but there's one question that always gives me trouble. Actually, it's two questions. How can we oppose the Palestinian right of return to homes that they lost in Israel while supporting and emphasizing property rights? On the other hand, if Israel were to let in, you know, to recognize the right of return, let in all the Palestinian refugees, they would most likely vote to destroy, to dismantle Israel legally and vote in a dictatorship.
Yeah, so part of what I try to do in my book is address the issue of the refugees. So right of return for you guys is, it's the claim that, well, there are all these refugees and we have to recognize that they are entitled to go back and reclaim their lost homes and property. There are all kinds of things to say about that. And I think from a perspective that recognizes property rights. And I think one of them is where there is someone who can show that he has lost property and it's still around, it's available, there should be a means to reclaim it, right? If what he's trying to do is actually reclaim his property. But that brings us to the question of what is this right of return as a claim or as a grievance, right? Now, it is really peculiar that the number of refugees who are the Palestinian refugees, instead of dwindling because of the natural fact of human mortality, it has only increased. Why is that? Well, there's a special way in which the Palestinians define a refugee, and it includes not just people who left at the time of the war in 1947, 48, and some in 67, but their children and their children in perpetuity. Now, that's a very peculiar way of thinking about refugees. which suggests, and I think there is a whole agenda behind it, which is, well, we're going to create a whole bunch of people who are refugees. We're going to insist on their right to return, irrespective of if they actually have claims. Because if you were born, if you're the grandson of someone like that, what property are you going back to? I mean, maybe you were, it was inherited to you. I don't see how that's the case. So there's a real agenda behind the right of return that has to be unmasked. And once you do that, you can say, well, look, if there are real questions here, well, let's find some way. Now, there are going to be cases, and I think this is true, where there's no just solution to it because the property's gone, and we can't prove that you owned it. Where's the title deed? It's so much time has passed. And it's just a fact of war that happens. And it's sad. You can acknowledge it, but I don't think there's a way in which you can satisfy that claim, which goes to the other aspect, which is part of it an attempt to bring a whole bunch of people, make them citizens, and then vote the country in a different direction? I think that is part of the goal. I think that's a big part of it. And that's a bizarre goal. And I don't think that can be taken, sort of accepted as, well, okay, well, you've got a right of return. It's not a uniform principle that all refugees at all times get to go back. And many of them wouldn't want to.
So you might experience something that doesn't happen much at Objectivist Conference, a disagreement. I don't believe there are any valid claims in this sense. They initiated a war. They attacked. They have been engaged in war for, 70 years? I think it would be very unusual if a family could show that they had nothing to do with it, that they legitimately were kicked out, that they have been on the side of peace all along. Yes, so you could imagine something like that. But look, you suffer the consequences of your actions. You go to war and you lose. Get over it. Get a life. And this is why, and this is, now some people will say, but wait a minute, this is collectivism. Their political leaders went to war and these individuals are suffering the consequences. Well, so one, you'd have to show that you were opposed to the war, that you were kicked out and you've been opposed to the war since. But more than that, look, at the end of the day, we suffer the consequences of our political leaders. What our political leaders do has a real impact on our lives. This is why it's so important to care about politics and to be involved in politics and to care about what our political leaders do, because if they do something bad, we get screwed. So they are the victims, and for some of them, a small minority, I think, they are truly victims. Mm-hmm. For the majority, I think they supported their political leaders. They are the victims of that political leadership, and part of the consequence of that is that they lost their home and they lost their property. And they're going to have to get on with life, you know, in a different country, in a different place. And given their hostility, given that they have been initiating force for 70 years, I don't see how you can justify, except for rare cases, any kind of legitimate property rights, given that they initiated force. Once you initiate force, property rights out the window.
Okay, good talk. Thanks very much. Years ago, when I lived in Europe, I heard the following kind of moral equalizing the argument that there were Israeli terrorists against the British, King David Hotel bombing. So isn't it, you know, it's not surprising that, or I mean, it shouldn't be surprising that the Israelis should, you know, they don't have a lot of moral background in opposing the PLO at the time when I heard the argument. Now, my BS detector went off a lot when I heard that argument, and I don't really buy it, even if it were true. But could you say something about the resistance to the British that this argument seems to be based on?
Sure. So this is in the period if you remember the timeline, this is in the dotted line before 1947 when there was the partition plan. And the British were ruling this territory from about 1912, 17, something like that, through 47.
Post-World War I, yeah, so 1917 onwards.
Yeah, they were around, yeah. So the resistance to the British, so let's start with the question of the fact that's often thrown around is that there was a terrorist bombing of this hotel. Now, I think the resistance was significant in part because the British had made claims and contradictory claims. And I think the what became the Israeli side of this, they definitely felt this was a real crisis for them. Like this is at the time when people are coming over in boats trying to flee Europe. And so I think they saw this as, well, we need to get what we were promised here. There really is a need for a refuge here. I don't think it's equal because this is where it's important what the Israeli side of this was doing. Now, there are better people and not so good people on the Israeli side, but I think fundamentally they were trying to create a society where people could live, and that means live in freedom. And if you look at some of the thinkers behind this movement, there were sort of avowed secularists, and then there was people sort of middle of the ground, but basically what they wanted is, we want a basically free society. And on the other side, and this is true even at the time, so the Arab-Palestinian resistance, and then later the Arab states and then the Palestinians, across the board, what did they want? So they wanted to dominate. They wanted to create an authoritarian regime. Now, the tactic that you use to resist and kind of achieve your goal, I mean, yeah, you can call it terrorism, and terrorism is a bad thing, but it's part of a campaign to achieve either freedom or to enslave people. And that, I think, is the fundamental that has to be seen here.
Right.
And they use this point, right? This is a big part of, well, look, we can point to Menachem Begin, who was Israel's prime minister. He was in the underground, and that obviously he's like Arafat. No, he's not. I mean, whatever you think of his history in the underground, and I'm not a big fan of his work, but there's a huge difference between we're really liberators and you guys are frauds. You're not liberating anybody. And I think that's really significant to this.
Yeah, I mean, the essential is that moral evaluation. The Jews were freedom fighters. And yes, they used some terror tactics. But terror tactics can be legitimate in the fight for freedom. The Palestinians are not fighting for freedom. They're fighting for authoritarianism. They're fighting for slavery. And their goal is to eradicate all Jews from Israel. Their goals are evil. So there is a difference between freedom fighters and fighters for slavery, and there's a moral difference. So it's not about the tactics, it's about the goal.
Okay, thanks, good.
And by the way, with the hotel, with the King David Hotel, they called up in advance and said, we're putting a bomb in the hotel, it's gonna explode at this hour, evacuate the hotel. And the British said, yeah, we don't believe you. So they didn't evacuate the hotel, so people died. But part of, I think, what happens when you're a freedom fighter is you actually do try to minimize innocent casualties. And I think for most of the activities of the Jewish fighters against the British, they definitely try to minimize innocent casualties, and their primary targets were military, were British soldiers occupying the territory.
Yeah, and the PLO rarely did that.
To PLO has never done that, and they've murdered children, guess that was a joke, sorry.
let me add one thing about that, because I think, I don't know how much you guys know about the history of the PLO's terrorism. This speaks to their goal, and their contempt for human life. So it isn't just that they would carry out these attacks, and be bold about it, they would fight among themselves to claim credit for it. And not only that, they would exaggerate the death toll, because in their mindset, the more you kill, the more honor you have. Now that tells you something significant. You can't honestly be for freedom and human life if what you think of is, I have to be the first one to claim credit, even if I wasn't the one responsible for these murders, and inflate it because you want to be seen as the one with the most blood on your hands.
So, Yaron, you partially answered my question, but there's an addition to it. There was violence in the beginning to displace the Palestinians as well as Jews to create the State of Israel. And still, when politics change and a settlement given back to Palestinians, the Jewish settlers are forcibly removed. Is this violence morally sanctionable or acceptable for the purpose of having Israel?
So which violence? I'm trying to say.
Well, I guess you answered the first one, but the second one as well. Just in general, is violence justifiable for the goal of having a civilized society?
In self-defense it is, and it is in self-defense, right? So if somebody is attacking you, the only option you have is to use violence to defend yourself. And for the most part, I'm not saying that everything Israel's ever done is legitimate and was an act of self-defense. Not everything it did was. And there are cases, and this is where Ilan's right, there are cases where compensation is due because things were done that were not justified. But in 99% of the cases, the act was an act of self-defense, and in self-defense, violence is used. People are killed, land is taken, and that is a legitimate use of violence because it's a use in the act of self-defense.
Thank you.
Hi, you described the Arab-Israeli conflict in the 40s and 60s as being primarily about territory. And as you both know, Israel is a very small country with next to nothing in it in terms of useful resources. So I'm finding that a little difficult to accept. And I've always seen that conflict as being more about revulsion at the idea of a Jewish state in the region. Mm-hmm. So can you sort of describe why you've come to the conclusion that it's mainly about territory?
Yeah, it's really, so it's both of those things. So when I say territory, it's we can't have these Jews on the Arab land. And there is, I mean, there are things you would want if you're a dictator, right? You want access to the Mediterranean, which was one of the goals they had. And there's land. I mean, it's not the best land maybe, but it's land. And if you are a dictatorial regime, that matters, right? I mean, and you want to dominate people. So that's another part of it. There are people there and I'm going to be their ruler. Put yourself in the mindset of someone like, I don't know how many of you know Gamal Abdel Nasser. He was the leader of Egypt and who was the spearhead of the conflict at this time, sort of in the 50s onward. Now this is a guy who thinks he's a messiah. He really does. He's a sort of secular messiah. I'm gonna realize the dream of the Arab peoples and unite the whole Middle East as one country. And I'll volunteer to be the leader. I mean, this guy wants to dominate people. This is the dictatorial mindset. He wants control. So I think there's, yeah, for some of them it's just, well, there's the port of Haifa would be really cool to have. And it's just, well, we want to be in charge. And it's a very evil kind of motivation.
So I mean, I agree. At the end of the day, they don't want Jews there. But to say this isn't about territory is a little funny. Historically, right? No piece of land in all of human history has been fought over more than this tiny little sliver of land between the Jordan River and the Mediterranean. None in all of history. You know, everybody's wanted it from ancient times to today. And if you think in terms of geopolitics and you think about in terms of geography, it is the bridge between three continents. It sits at the intersection of Europe, Asia, and Africa, and every trade route goes through there. This is why the Suez Canal is so important. It's right there, right? And if so, from a geographical, strategic perspective, everybody wants that piece of land. Everybody's always wanted that piece of land, from the Greeks and the Romans to the Mesopotamians and the Babylonians, the Egyptians, to every modern empire of Ottomans, and it was fought over during World War I, and it was, and the Nazis were heading there. You know, Rommel, where was he heading? He was heading to there. I mean, not just there, also to the Arabian Peninsula to get the oil. But if you think about a piece of land, there is no piece of land fought over more than that little tiny, tiny sliver of land that Israel. And I don't think you know how small Israel is, because until you go there, you don't know how small it is. But The example I give is, if you drive from north to south on a highway, on a proper highway, it would take you 6 hours. If you drive the width of Israel, it would take you 40 minutes. That's the piece of land we're talking about that this conflict is all about. And that's a piece of land they want to divide into two so that there'd be a Palestinian state, right?
Thank you very much.
As I listened to your talk, I certainly agreed. And I agree wholeheartedly with your view that morality is on the side of Israel and the Israelis. My difficulty somewhat is with Andrew Breitbart's question, so what? If I look at the two of you as individuals and me as an individual, and you are in the right, you're being threatened by either a criminal, a religious lunatic, or a garden variety lunatic, I'm going to do what I can to support your rights. I'll certainly encourage the United States government to protect you. If you needed to borrow a gun and I had a gun, I would lend it to you. When it comes to the nation of the United States and the nation of Israel, Israel is in the right. The question, so what, mm-hmm. in Breitbart's formulation, I think becomes more complicated, at least to me. Mm-hmm. What does Israel's moral position mean sure. to the United States? Do we start getting into geopolitics? How much do they help us with espionage, you know, mm-hmm. intelligence gathering? Will we have bases there, et cetera? Or is it really more simple?
Could you guys put this slide up as part of my answer? I have a book on this subject. And I'm going to, part of what I do in the book is really answer that. But I want to give you a short answer now so that you don't have to wait until it comes. So there's a number of things. One, I think I tried to hint at this, but I'm sure it didn't come across as well as it should have. America's approach to this has really made it bad for Israel, but it's made it bad for America. Right? So America's policy in the Middle East, and specifically with regard to Israel, has encouraged, empowered, and sort of galvanized the Islamist movement. I mean, it is no accident, it is a direct consequence that Bush's policy in the Middle East put Hamas in power. It empowered Hezbollah in Lebanon. It allowed Iran to get further down the road towards dominating the region and getting nuclear weapons. Iran, Hezbollah, and Hamas are key players in this conflict. We even made them stronger, okay? So to me, that's sort of the big picture, is that we've made this much worse for ourselves by having these people get stronger. The other one is, so I guess the part of your question is getting to, what do you do about this? So do you lend them a gun? Well, I think that one of the big misconceptions is that America has been pro-Israel, right? So this is, the view is, when Rashid Khalidi and Walton Mearsheim are arguing, stop being so favorable to Israel, so that's assuming that we have been. I don't think that's true. I mean, in terms of material support, there's been money and there's military aid, but the one that's missing, and I think this is the crucial part of what needs to happen, is what has been lacking is a moral support. And it's not the only thing you need to do, but it's significant and it's been missing. So to give you a concrete, in 2006, there's a war between Israel and Hamas, and Israel and particularly Hezbollah. In 2012, there's another conflict with Israel and Hamas. 2014, another one. And in each of those, and those are two different administrations, right? There's Bush and then there's Obama. In both of those, there's a constant pattern in America's response. We've given you all this military weapon, you've got the military edge, which is true. But as soon as the fighting breaks out, it's, whoa, you're not actually going to defend yourselves, are you? Don't do that. We don't feel comfortable with that. Show some restraint. And so in the war with Hezbollah in 2006, Israel, I think, is fully capable of completely eliminating Hezbollah. It didn't do that. And I think a big part of it was the pressure to come back to a ceasefire, which was pushed by Condoleezza Rice under George Bush. And they ran to the UN to, well, let's stop this. When what you should have said is, go for it. Now, these people are trying to kill you. You have the military weapons. You're in the right. Go do it. And the moral sanction is what's missing here. The same thing happened in 2012, 2014. Hamas was rocketing civilians, right? And they managed to reach most of the country. Obama's response to that was, you guys need to show a lot more restraint. And, you know, what does he have to say about Hamas? They were pretty irresponsible. Now, that is perverse. I mean, you can't have that view. And to me, a big part of what's happened in this conflict is America's role in this has been to undermine Israel's moral standing. And what it should be doing is saying, we're on the same side. We think you should win. And we want you to win, and we have a common enemy here, right? It's a good thing for us if these factions are eliminated and minimized. And we've done exactly the opposite. So that's part of the so what answer.
So we got 4 minutes, so short questions.
So how does your summary that leads to the conclusion that moral judgments are must be taken seriously, how does that play to the Conoscenti within the university where you did your graduate work, or if that's too narrow, just within experts who know this area. Do you get any traction?
I'll see when I push the argument sort of more formally in the book. I have reason to expect there to be a lot of resistance, because my view is not only is moral judgment missing, but to the extent people invoke morality, they have a very warped view of it. So when people tell you they're for justice in Palestine, that does not mean justice in the way you or I or Ayn Rand would mean justice, which is who is actually a victim judged by the facts and by a moral objective standard. Their view of justice is the weak and the needy, by that fact, are the victims. And so that I call it the underdog premise. Like, whoever's the underdog has to be, like, there has to be something on their side. And if you're the strong side, it can't possibly be true that you I guess it's just not plausible. But that's false. I mean, you can find all kinds of examples of weak parties that are vicious and strong parties that are innocent. And so the part of the challenge is there's a wrong view of justice, and then to the extent they have it, they don't want to apply it, which is, I mean, in some cases that would be would make things worse. So it's two things that I'm pushing. I'm pushing not just that we need moral judgment, we need a rational conception of what morality means, what it looks like to be just in this context. I'm hoping there's some openings and people will be responsive to it. I think it remains to be seen.
Okay, thanks. I just thought that demonstration you did when you were on one side of the stage and walked to the other, I'd love to see the reaction of somebody who is doing what you're suggesting sees that, because it's so clear. Thank you.
Thank you. What is your evaluation, please, of the Camp David Accords, which I understand led to the Nobel Peace Prize, which you mentioned?
The ones with Jimmy Carter?
Yes.
I know a little about them, and I think there's one good thing that came out of it was they were trying to package into that a recognition of the Palestinian cause, and they pushed that out, which kind of pushed them to the margins a bit more, which I think was a good thing. That's a sort of minor detail. I think it was a good thing that there is now a peace agreement between Israel and Egypt. So Egypt historically has been at the forefront of the attacks against Israel. The wars were led by Egypt, and the Palestinian Liberation Organization was instigated and hugely funded by Egypt. It wasn't a great kind of peace, but it was peace in the sense that there was no conflict, there was some kind of recognition. It didn't make anything, like the real hostility, go away, but it was good. In that respect, I think it was a good thing.
I mean, I think we could quibble about some details of the accord, particularly the dismantling of Israeli Jewish settlements in the Sinai. Why couldn't they just stay under Egypt's control? But I think that Sadat has to be evaluated as incredibly courageous for being willing to come to Jerusalem, willing to lead and to actually advocate for peace in a world in which, in a culture in which, you know, he was denounced for such an act. So overall, you have to evaluate it as a positive. And of course, Sadat died, mm-hmm. was murdered partially, not exclusively, partially because of the deal he made. And I think one wonders what would have happened if he had stayed in power, because I really think, well, I suspect, I mean, it's hard to really tell, but I suspect he was honest about his desire for peace, and the dynamics in the Middle East might have been different if he stayed in power in Egypt and not be murdered. Quickly.
Hi, I'm relatively new to objectivism. That's my first time, and I'm struggling to apply it consistently to issues like this. So yesterday in the discussion about cronyism, we talked about eminent domain and how Trump was trying to take a parking lot from a woman, and the point was that it was her property, it was her choice regardless of how she chose to use that property. So with the emphasis of rights on property, regardless of intent of use, shouldn't objectivism reject the idea of cutting out a piece of land and favoring the Israeli use of it? I understand and I agree that they promote more freedom and they have better economics than the Arabs would if they did control the land. And like you said, the fact and the reality is of war, they have had the land and there's no realistic way of giving that land back and claims and all that. But as of right now, with that mindset and the emphasis of rights of objectivism, shouldn't objectivists then defend the remaining land of the Palestinians and reject Israeli expansion, regardless of how the Palestinians would?
You mean like the settlements and?
Yes, exactly.
Two quick points. So one is, it's little known, but it's well documented that when the founders of Israel came, they spent their time buying land. They were bidding up the price of land to the point where the Arabs were falling over each other to sell it. And that was a big, by the time that they declared independence, they had acquired basically all the land that was going to become part of the state, as far as I think that's right. And what comes after that is there's land that they acquire through conquest in war of self-defense, and there's quite a bit of land that comes from. And I think that's legitimate to do in a conflict. On the question of settlements, that's a very big topic, but I will sort of, and I deal with it in my book, but I'll tell you this. I think it's a combination of at least three different things. There are legitimate uses of the land that Israel is allowing people to build on and create homes and businesses. There is land that is owned and verifiably owned by people who shouldn't have it taken away. It's really an analog to eminent domain, and I'm against that. And there are cases where people have fought back against that and reclaimed their land. And then there's kind of a gray zone of what some of the religionist Jews do, which is, I think, sort of violates the rule of law, which is they try to take over land that is not theirs and turn it into territory for Israel. I mean, those people are breaking the law. The Israeli authorities, for the most part, uproot them. But one has to kind of step back, because we can get into the weeds here, but the key point about that issue of the settlements is it's mentioned and invoked as an explanation for why the Palestinians are so upset and what needs to happen. If only we could stop the settlements, said Barack Obama and his administration, we would have peace. Now that's just a myth. That's just not true. There are problems with the settlements, and there's fine things with the settlements, but you can't hang everything on the settlements. And I agree with you. The way to clarify this issue is with the principle of property rights. But that's not what they're trying to do. What they're trying to do is create, this is a neat solution, let's just pretend that there's nothing else the Palestinians are really trying to do here. And that's my perspective on it.
Yeah, I mean, Israel recently passed a law that makes it much easier to confiscate private land on the West Bank for the purpose of settlements. And I think we deposed a law like that. I think to the extent that there's real property rights violations, we oppose it, but don't assume that everything you hear about settlements is a violation of property rights. It's not, and I agree completely with Ilan. That's a facade for the real issue. I mean, this is, you know, just in one sentence, this is my view. The Palestinians will be ready for peace, truly ready for peace, when they embrace the settlements as, whoa, we get these Jews living among us. They bring jobs. They're very creative. They're very productive. They seem to have great technology. Wouldn't it be great if, when we have a Palestinian state, if that ever happened, we had these Jews stay among us, right? Instead of wanting to dismantle them, kick them out, and destroy. So they would be ready for peace when the settlements were not an issue. Quite the contrary, they viewed the settlements as a virtue, not a vice.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Ayn Rand Institute Live podcast. Subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you listen. You can also find us on YouTube. If you like this content, please share or leave us a review. For more information, go to AynRand.org.